It is Saturday, May 26th, 2007, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, our week in geek news, and in the second half, your questions and comments of technology.
Geek Speak is a production of KUSP, Central Coast Public Radio, kusp.org. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today, we take your questions and comments of technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can send us email. Just go to geekspeak.org. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour during the first half of the show. We'll be doing geek news. Everything that happened this week, including personal stories of our computer dilemmas. Geek Speak on KSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue, online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the room with me are geeks Miles Elam, a slacker, a geek, and student. Morning, Miles.
Morning.
Sean Cleveland, technical marketing manager at NVIDIA. Sean?
Good morning, Lyle.
And Ryder Brooks, technical account manager at SCO.
Good morning.
Is it SCO or SCO?
It's SCO now. It's the SCO Group.
The SCO Group. I'll change that in my script. So, hi, geeks. What's happened in the world of geekdom this week?
Well, first of all, I don't know that I'd like to go into psychology all that much on a technology show. However, this one did strike my fancy.
You seem to, like, every week.
And Miles, when has it ever stopped you before?
Do it!
But this one has to do with math. It has to do with math performance. Specifically, it has to do with math performance between boys and girls. What a group of psychologists from the University of Chicago, led by C.N. Baylock, assistant professor in psychology, who was the lead investigator on the study, basically had two groups of people, a control group and your experiment group. And with the control group, they just told them, okay, we're doing this test on math, so here's this test, take it. And we're going to see how it goes.
Okay.
The other one, they said, well, we want to see why boys do so much better than girls at math. And then gave them the test. The ones that were told of the stereotype performed worse.
Wow.
Markedly worse than the ones that were...
What age group was this?
This was of... I'm sorry, this one I don't know because it just says telling girls and boys.
So
I don't think it has the ages listed here.
I mean, the thing that's interesting, of course, is that in the case where they clearly said this is to test that, you know, why boys are better at math,
mm-hmm.
they gave that pretext, and the other people they didn't. The other people still have a social pretext of that, so it would... I mean, I would assume that if the social structures were set up, women would do even better.
When they interviewed the experimentees,
uh-huh.
What they found was that the ones that were told of this bias were fixated on, wait, why do boys do better than girls? I don't want to mess up. And so they're spending so much time worrying about getting the right answer that they weren't getting the right answer.
Right.
Whereas the ones that weren't told this were able to concentrate more fully on the problem and thus do better. Now, this is not going to be limited to just boys and girls. They have found a similar behavior with regard to ethnicity, with regard to religion. Anytime it turns out that you tell someone, I don't think you're going to do as well. You know, don't worry so much because I don't expect much of you. They're going to do worse. If you expect more or you just don't mention it, people are going to perform at the level of their ability. At least that's what this study is saying and what other similar studies have said.
All right, cool.
I'm sorry. You were asking about age. I now see that it was 200 college women.
Okay. Speaking of college women and math, I was going by the engineering department yesterday. I work at UCSC, and I'm walking by a room, and I see on the blackboard stuff that I'm barely able to understand what it is. Differential equations, actually. And I'm like, oh, cool, some physics class. So I peeked in the room. I would say 80% women in the class, 20% men. And I told that later. I was like, interesting. And someone was like, why? Was it a special class? I'm like, no, that's the college dynamic now. More women are going to college than men. And I see it all the time, especially when – and it's very prominent when you're in the engineering department, which all the faculty are guys. I mean, at least a lot of them are. The dynamic 20 years ago was very different than what it is now. It's kind of exciting. Thank you very much for that story, Miles. Let's go on to Ryder.
Okay. Interesting statement that Intel came out with in regards to software developers not really keeping up to speed with hardware advances. There's a Moore's Law. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's basically kind of a technology rule that speed of hardware advances doubles every 18 months to 2 years.
And the price drops in
and
half.
The price drops.
Theoretically,
and,
yeah.
I thought it was specifically the number of transistors.
It was the transistors, but it's been kind of stretched and manipulated over the years.
I think you're right. Yeah.
And that's held up pretty well, the doubling
transistors.
It's
held up pretty well, and it's probably even doing better these days.
And there's some futurists that say, because of this explosion, at some point we'll see this catastrophic change in the world. Not catastrophic, but change where we'll get smart computers because the hardware is going to be so amazing. And this study's talking a bit about the software problems.
Well, it's talking about the software problem. One of the major shifts that have occurred lately is with these dual-core processors. There's been a shift to parallel computing where you basically are running tasks simultaneously rather than having one monolithic processor that just cranks out and goes really fast. We basically run into a physical limit in how fast these CPUs can do with current technology. So they're spreading it out sideways and doing things in parallel.
And these are these
dual core. I mean, this has been around for quite a while on a server end where you could have like 8 CPUs that traditionally we didn't have these dual cores, and now they're stacking those on top of. So you'll have 8 physical CPUs with dual or quad cores inside of them, and you just have massive amounts of processing.
Now I get the idea that that's not the same as making one processor faster and faster and faster. But there is more computing power in a dual core system. Mm-hmm. So the software has to be smarter. And how's it doing?
According to Intel, they're falling behind. They're kind of sticking to this old model and not taking advantage of the parallel processing. You see this, I think, right now is pretty evident in the game development community where they're not really taking advantage of all the power of these CPUs that they could be using. You do see it with applications like Photoshop and video processing.
You do see them using the dual core?
You do see them using parallel processing. Like Macintosh has been dual core for a while, and most of their applications support that.
Is that an operating system decision, or is it actually also the software, individual software?
Well, the operating system has to support multi-processing, but it is most of the operating systems now take advantage of that. So it really falls on the software developers to optimize their software to use that.
I see. So
and it's a shift in paradigm in the way people program because it's true multi-threading and
Miles, as a programmer, you know about how to set up applications to take advantage of dual core. Is it pretty complicated or is it just a multi-processing trick that you have to do?
It depends. If you have something like a Unix environment where you have a lot of small programs running, it's going to be taken care of by the operating system. It's going to distribute it to the different CPUs.
What about you writing an application if you were to write,
If I were programming, for example, for Windows, that means I would have to be writing a multi-threaded application and have things that were very distinct. It's not...
Could you see that a game developer would not take advantage right now and actually program their game for the
dual
hardware?
I can absolutely see that because the game development a lot of times tends to be very serial. You want to have this happen, then this happens, and this happens, and this happens, and not as much things happening in parallel.
Actually, Gas-Powered Games' new Supreme Commander, a real-time strategy game, is multiprocessor enabled, and you can see really large performance gains
I bet.
With dual and even quad-core chips.
Right, as long as you program it that way.
Then that's the way it's programmed. So, and you know what? They are getting a lot of traction from that. A lot of people like that. CPU sales are... I'm hearing people say, I'm thinking about buying a better chip just so my Supreme Commander plays better. I've heard that from two different people, believe it or not.
Yeah.
And so if the software people will make it happen, people will go out of their way to buy software that's optimized for their hardware, especially if they spend a lot of money on that hardware.
And so, Ryder, what you're saying is that Intel's kind of complaining because not a lot of software vendors are doing this. They're not taking advantage of their hardware.
Yeah. I mean, and I think that they acknowledge that they've really kind of created a disruption in the way that software development works by shifting to this model, but it's...
But haven't we wanted dual-core stuff for a long time? I mean...
Let's also put it this way. Well, dual-core, not necessarily for gaming.
Double processing. Yeah.
But...
Multitasking, think of, it's great. You know, I think...
Last
times
we've bought games, the games have had patches because there have been bugs, because there have been issues. Mm-hmm. Coding for multiple processors or, you know, coding in a multi-threaded environment is noticeably more difficult. So if you can imagine games having a certain level of bugs now, it becomes that much harder of a development problem. Yeah. And that's probably why people have been not jumping on
I can see where people would think it's kind of lazy on the hardware developer side to take a assembly line that's in place, right?
Yeah.
And you're able to picture shrinking that assembly line down into a smaller footprint and then fitting more of the exact same assembly lines in that footprint.
Right.
That's what's happening on the chip level, right? So there's not a lot of innovation going on. It's not going to come up with this new assembly line process that deals with things in a faster way.
Well, this
is more about using the same assembly line, but there's more of them now.
Right. So it's like building a second warehouse right next to your primary warehouse.
But in fairness,
as you shrink the transistors down at the chip level, you make more real estate, and you either use it for cache or you put more or processor cores in there. And now the software, you know, it's easy for a hardware company to do this. I mean, relatively, right? They've done it in like a year's time. It's crazy. Right. But it's a lot more work in the software side to get this done.
Right. For gaming, that's one thing. For server applications, if you're talking about a web server or database server, those have been multiprocessor, multi-threaded for many, many years. So that's one where the multi-core CPUs have made tremendous strides.
Speaking of multiple core CPUs. The new GeekSpeak server, which is not in place yet, does have multiple cores. We won't get into the technology behind it, but I've been seeing performance issues with it. It's amazing. I mean, it's very quick, and it's much more like I can start up multiple tasks.
You're saying performance issues with it?
No, performance gains. Quality gains.
Yes.
Yeah. I see multiple, you know, multiple tasks.
It is distinguishing itself. Yeah.
And you really notice it because I haven't taken a look at HTOP in that to see what it looks like when you peg one of the processors and the other processors are sitting idle ready to go. It's pretty cool. Anyway, let's go on another news story. Sean, I believe it's your turn. Thank you, Ryder, for that story on processors and software.
Yeah, Hewlett-Packard launched a really cool thing, online rebates. So, say they asked their customers, you know, what are things you'd like to see changed? And that was the number one thing, make rebates easier.
Yeah. Rebates are so hard.
Because, you know, you got to get a special coupon sometime. You got to get your receipt. You got to cut out something from a box, throw it all in an envelope, fill out a form. I mean, geez.
And then end up on 20 billion mailing lists.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's always fun.
So now HP, when you buy a product that has a rebate, all you have to do to redeem that is go to their website, and give them two pieces of information, the order number and the billing zip code.
Nice. Very nice. So you give them those two pieces of information.
And you probably got to give them your address, too.
And you're, and they
say, of course, they got to send you the
money. It'd be great if you could give them the credit card and it just puts money on the credit card. That would be nice. All right. So
maybe not credit card, but like a PayPal account.
Yeah, that'd be cool, right? Definitely.
Just drop that rebate into my PayPal and good to go. I don't know. It'll get there.
Yeah. I think it's a good move on HP's perspective.
I hope we see that from other people.
I always thought these companies, though, when they do the rebates, assume that there's not going to be 100% acceptance on the rebate.
I thought they made it difficult for a reason.
Yeah, right. I did too. So it's interesting that they're saying, no, we want to make it easy. I like that take. All right, thank you very much, Sean, for HP's move.
Of course, you know, it takes some resources to do that.
It does.
Right? So it's not every company's going to be able to do this right away.
Miles, I'd like to go to you.
New Jersey is suing YouTube over the state of New Jersey is suing YouTube over an auto crash video that's being shown on YouTube or featured. The reason for this is that New Jersey states that because the crash happened on the New Jersey Turnpike, it is therefore the property of the Turnpike and cannot be distributed openly.
The footage is the
property. Yeah, I wish everyone in the audience could see Lyle's response to this as he cocks his head kind of like a dog going,
Thanks, Miles. I think it's too early for you to call me a canine, but maybe later in the day. So they're claiming that they own the footage, or they have a copyright claim because it happened on their property.
Mm-hmm. They are requesting that the footage be removed under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act.
Oh. Interesting. I mean, I kind of see it because if you're making a film in New Jersey, you're going to have to pay the film commission and get licenses. So anytime you film, in a certain location, you have to get permissions, and that permission waives their rights to the copy.
Presumably, there's private property and the like. They're saying this is because of New Jersey. The state of New Jersey owns it as government property. At the same time, if it's going to be, if you take photos of someone, if you take photos of government property, one, government property is owned, in theory, by the public. And two, that sets a precedent of, well, if you take a picture of someone's private property, can they sue you because you took a picture of their house from the street?
Yeah. I also think it's interesting, mm-hmm. if they want to claim that they own the copyright of the accident, aren't they to some degree claiming responsibility? I mean, it seems to me that if I put a camera up, for example, in my place of business and someone falls and breaks their leg, and then I say, no, I own the copyright on that because, you know, I own the equipment. Isn't the victim also going to be like, you're going to make money off this? You're claiming ownership of my accident? I mean, it seems to me that the accident victims have much more claim of copyright than anybody else, except for maybe the person that made the footage. Okay, thanks. I'd like to hear what happens to that. You know, the whole state suing kind of thing is kind of a scary situation. States are immune from lawsuits, so that they can do a lawsuit for copyright is kind of scary to me. Thank you, Miles, for that story of ridiculous state's theoretical rights. Hi, Ryder.
Hi. So I feel like I'm going on these, interference things all the time, but I found a new one about Nissan. Their high-end vehicles have it's called an iKey, and it's basically a digital key similar to what the Toyota Priuses have for unlocking your car.
They call it the iKey?
It's called the iKey.
I'm surprised Apple's
Nissan
not suing.
iKey. Okay. And they made a statement basically saying that if you put your cell phone too close to it when you're receiving or sending a call, that you can actually scramble the contents of it and operate ineffective.
Making your car not work.
Your car will not open. You can't unlock the car.
Who
you can't
would put a
it.
Cell phone next to keys? Who doesn't? My cell phone and my keys are right next to each other.
And it is not reprogrammable. You have to basically get your key unit replaced, and that may... You may need to get part of your car replaced, too, to fit that key.
Technology making our lives easier every day. You know, the other day I had my cell phone and my keys next to a metal key, and the cell phone just ripped all the key the points off the key, just wiped it clean. No, kidding. But anyway. The point is that, you know, if it was a physical key, that wouldn't happen. Yes. Sean, you've got one of these I-type key things. I'm sure it's not called an I-key, but I was playing with it earlier
today. My I-Prius key.
Your little Prius fobby thing. Yeah. Does it have interference problems? Can we zap it?
No.
Let's throw it in a microwave and see what happens. No?
Why not? I have another one.
Thanks, Ryder, on the Nissan
If it makes you happy,
IP.
Lyle, I will do it. Oh, wow. We should probably pull the battery out of it first.
In that case, give me money. Okay. So
will that make you happy?
You know, make me happy.
Give I got a couple dollars.
I'll take your car. Next story is yours, Mr. Cleveland.
So Sony is getting sued for Blu-ray patent infringement. You let that sink in. Target Technology, who designed thin metallic reflective layers in optical media, they filed a patent back in April of 2004. It was approved in March 2006. And now they're going back to Sony and saying, hey, we think you knew about this and you were just pushing this under the rug, but you're violating our patent and we want an immediate injunction until this is resolved. They would like all Blu-ray titles pulled off shelves. They're seeking damages and interest of an undisclosed sum, and they want those damages multiplied because they feel that Sony knew this.
I'm sorry, what was the patent for again?
The patent was for a thin metallic reflective layer that's used in Blu-ray media.
Some kind of process of making them layer.
I asked that because I had read the patent and was talking about using silver and a bunch of other materials
for
to do
with
reflective surface.
It's a corrosion-protecting layer.
Yeah.
Hey, Miles, sometimes patents are okay.
No, it kind of sounded to me like they were patenting the mirror, but...
No, it's a layer.
Hey,
it has to
you know
do
what?
With...
I bet there's a lot of patents on a CD, and they work real well, and there's a lot of engineering going to them. I'm not going to totally dispute it.
Okay.
It's not like they're patenting an organism or a number.
Aren't you guys just kind of getting annoyed with all these lawsuits left and right over everything these days?
I'm interested, this frustrating. This company that does this, how many employees do they have? Like 50 employees? They're trying to get a couple billion dollars? I mean, you know, what are they actually doing? Because Sony's not going to pull all
You know, they probably have a bunch
off.
More employees now
yeah.
in the form of lawyers.
You got a lot of money.
I also wonder about...
Because it's very lucrative to go after patent infringement, you know, especially when it's a large company like Sony.
I also wonder how long Blu-ray discs have been out that they... now decided to do it. Right. Have we not been able to see samples to see that it might have done? Whatever.
So Sony sent us a Blu-ray drive, which I installed, and I've been watching movies on. I put it in the media center, installed Vista on it. I've been checking it out. Wow. Really, you know what it's like? To really describe HD DVD and Blu-ray movies, you've probably seen HD DVD, HD television shows, right?
Well, I have.
Come over to my house, you've seen it on the big screen. Have you ever been in a store and you've
seen... Hey, California, everybody been to Sean's house?
You've seen... any store has it. You see high definition. It's just, it's that for movies. But what a difference it makes compared to DVD. It makes DVD look like old VHS tapes. It's pretty incredible.
I pulled out a USB webcam the other day. I was setting it up to do some digital art. And I looked at it and I was like, yeah, this looks like my first, the quality of it looked like the first video, you know, VCR camera that I had, the real big things that should sit on your shoulder and have a, you know, a VCR that you have to strap on. And that was the kind of the quality, the really bad color, blurriness. And I kind of felt, you know, there was a sense of awe and I kind of liked it, the quality of it. But that's a completely opposite. Going from, it almost feels like you're going to a movie theater when you see HD content. So what you're saying is right now, with the Blu-ray disc that you purchased, I'm assuming, you can play that in your media center.
I think it looks
center.
Better than a movie theater.
Better than a movie theater.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it really does.
Now, okay, that's
because
you
got to understand a movie theater is still old technology. It's film with lights. This is digital. Much sharper. Okay. Unless you go to a digital theater. There are very few of those.
I won't argue the merits of that because that's a long discussion. We can talk about CDs and turntables too if you want. But I do want to talk about the point that last week someone called in again. I was almost every week, and you weren't here last week. And they said, you know, should I buy a Vista machine or not? And I asked around the geeks and said, anybody running Vista? And all of us weren't. And all that. But now this week I installed Vista at work just to try it out and start using it. I'm pretty happy with it. The machine's high enough quality that it works. And you're running two Vista machines at your house, mm-hmm. one for your media center with this Blu-ray disc in it and one for a work machine.
Yeah.
How's that going for you?
It's just Vista Enterprise. I'm doing more on that. But you know that it's pretty identical to the high-end Vista Ultimate. And don't ask me what the differences are between because
I don't want to talk about the 15 different flavors of Vista,
Vista by itself, yeah, you know, I'm really starting to grow into it. The interface is really nice looking. I'm getting used to that, and the way the control panel is organized. I'm more impressed with Office 2007 than I am with Vista, but there are little things about Vista that I like. When I open up Windows Explorer and I'm looking at I'm looking at files in the left hand navigation pane. When directory names get really long, and then you've got a whole list of them, as you move up and down the list, before you had to move the bottom slider bar left and right,
right.
just to read what was going on, unless you stretch that window, Vista just moves that automatically for you.
Oh,
it's kind of neat. It's just it's little things like that that I am finding in Vista. Mm-hmm. They're like little gems of cool little, you know, the way things work. It's just the way dialog boxes and data is given to you functionally is much smarter than XP. And I'm starting to appreciate that.
All right, good. So you're moving towards that. Would you recommend at this point, I mean, if your dad said, I'm going to buy a new computer, should I get Vista? Would you say yes or no on?
If you're buying a new computer, I would say, yeah, why not? If you're upgrading from an old computer, then I think you really need to go through their compatibility. When you first put the disk in, it'll go off and find if the hardware that's connected to your computer is compatible with Vista, mm-hmm. and if there's drivers for it, I would definitely do that first. If you have, you know, existing hardware, especially scanners and printers, and make sure there are drivers available, even the hardware inside the machine. If you're doing an upgrade, I'd be really wary. If Windows XP is working fine for you, there's no reason to get rid of it. Really, there's no reason at all. New computer, yes.
Geek Speak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation, offering one appointment, crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. You're listening to Geek Speak. We are now taking your calls with questions and comments of technology. The numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. You can, of course, use the internet. Go to geekspeak.org to send us a message. Again, the phone numbers to call in now with any questions or comments of technology, the lines are open. You can ask more opinions about Vista that Sean is now using, or in general, any dilemmas you might be having with your computer. We'll try to answer them. Phone numbers are 476-2800, again, 476-2800, or toll-free anywhere in California, 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. 855-KUSP. Stay tuned with KUSP for Castle Cottage this morning at 11 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. My name's Lyle Troxell. You're listening to Geek Speak. The geeks this morning are Ryder Brooks, Miles Elam, Sean Cleveland. We're taking your calls with questions and comments of technology. We're going to talk a little bit more about Vista because I'm a little curious. We might do a couple more news stories, but in general, we're here to support your frustrations with technology because we all like technology a lot and think it's the savior that, no, look, maybe not that far. GeekSpeak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. Give us a call if you'd like to ask us a question, 476-2800, toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Miles, do you have a point?
Yeah, I actually had to make a correction on a news story I made. I was a bit too inflammatory. I read a little bit more about it, and yeah, I was basically wrong. The
Is
New
that
Jersey
this
story,
week's news story?
Yeah, okay. The New Jersey story, talking about posting up to YouTube. Something that I forgot, which was a very important part to the story, was that the video was from a New Jersey Turnpike Authority video camera.
It was there.
Changes a lot
equipment.
To it, and suddenly I feel remiss in missing that particular point.
That's valid. So the equipment that was used to do this was, and it was probably an employee at the time that was doing it, that videotaped it.
And the reason why they're suing YouTube is because even though YouTube agreed to take the video down, a lot of users, which is common with YouTube, will put up the exact same video under their own name, their own heading, and YouTube has been slow to pull down the duplicates, to find the duplicates, and that is what they're suing them over.
All right. Could let me ask you this. Why would a state claim a copyright as in this is protected information versus copyright this is open to the public? I mean, what about the idea of a Creative Commons? When does the content that's being generated by the state inherently belong to everyone because it is our government that's doing it?
That's a fine question. I don't have an answer to that.
There's a bit of research up at UCSC involved in the program that I'm involved in, digitalarts.ucsc.edu. The project is called MetaVid. I think I've talked about it before. It's metavid.ucsc.edu. And it's basically a Avid Stern and Michael Dale have been recording C-SPAN's footage of the House and Senate floor hearing footage. And they found out through the process that even though C-SPAN actually is the one that that actually broadcasts it, government cameras actually recorded it in the first time and gave it government employees, you know, run the cameras. And because of that, it is non-copyrighted or Creative Commonsly copyrighted, that distribute. It's in the public domain because it's government officials recording it. And I would have bet that YouTube, if they wanted to fight on this side, could say, actually, there is no, you know, this is a public right.
But there's also precedent in the other direction, for example, with the UC system and Cal State system as well, research institutions that get government funds and then are still able to take advantage of the patents and license them out.
That's true.
So and that's not public domain, but right. That's used with public funds.
Right. All right. Well, thank you very much, Miles, for clarifying that story. We're taking calls, questions, and technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. We're going to go ahead and take a call from Santa Cruz. Jim, welcome to Geek Speak. Oh, I'm so
Hi.
Sorry. Hi, Jim. Yes.
Okay, so I built a computer about a year and a half to 2 years ago, and the CD player burner at some point in the past 4 or 5 months was overheating the CPU, and so I noticed it when I would be playing a CD or burning a CD, the motherboard would shut down. It would just stop. No matter all my programs would just die. When I rebooted, it would make a little sing-song noise and come up and say that, you know, whatever activity you were doing was overheating the CPU, the Intel motherboard. It's an Intel chip and an Intel motherboard. And so I went ahead and replaced the CD drive burner just recently in the past 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and it worked for a while. Like the first time I could go 5, 6, 8 minutes, and then it did the same thing. So it's something.
Wait, you're burning a disc or watching a movie?
No, I'm just putting a CD, a music CD, in and playing it, or writing, you know, burning, ripping it, you know, just
okay,
ripping
copying
music.
The CD. Okay.
Yeah,
that sounds like you just have a general heat issue.
Yeah, there's no way that your CD-ROM drive can overheat your CPU, because they don't generate heat.
I know.
The drives themselves don't really generate heat. What's happening is whatever you're doing with the drive is using is pushing the CPU utilization up, and then that is what's causing the heat.
And ripping CDs to MP3 is a perfect processor intensive.
Yeah,
thing.
It's very processor intensive. Exactly, that's what's going on. There's nothing to do with your CD-ROM drive. It has everything to do with whatever heat sink fan combination you have on your CPU.
What kind of CPU are you using?
It's
Intel. I knew you were going to ask me that. I was just trying to get to my office to look. It's the P4. It's like a 3 gigahertz.
Did you put this processor in?
Yes.
Did you use heat?
Thermal
heat
paste.
Now that they asked me that down at Santa Cruz Electronics, so I'm not sure. I don't know if I did.
Yeah. Okay.
You did it wrong probably. But
what I would do is go buy a third party heat sink cooler fan for Intel. It's socket 775. That's what you want to get.
I love you, Sean.
You're such a
and just they come with thermal paste and directions about how to apply it. And just pop off your old one, throw it away, put in a better heat sink cooler. That's exactly what's happening. If you didn't use thermal paste, then the connection for the heat sink, it's a metal, flat metal connection that sits on top of the CPU.
Right.
It's just not making contact well enough, and the CPU's heating, and it's not getting
specifically a layer of
the
air.
It's not
is
conducting
in there.
To the heat sink properly.
Right.
And you also want to make sure that you probably have an exhaust fan that's helping vent out the
hot
air.
Yeah, make sure you have fans in your case. And fans should be turned. Remember, these fans always blow towards the label, okay? So make sure that the fan in the front of the case is blowing into the case and the fans on the back of the case are blowing out of the case because you want to have airflow moving through the case.
Right. I think that is working. I checked that.
So you should be able to feel
both fans are operating.
You should be able to feel the back of the computer and have hot air hitting your hand.
Yeah. Right. And those 8 minutes that you were getting that it seemed like it worked after you switched the drive out, that just probably meant the amount of time that took you to replace that drive meant that the whole system had time to cool off.
Yeah.
Rather than the actual drive itself.
So exactly right.
So the trick here Sean's really recommending is when your processor's overheating and the machine's crashing like that, to get a new heatsink fan combination. Make sure it's the one that will fit your motherboard.
Right.
That's the whole socket thing. Socket 775 is what you have, as Sean says. And you just pull off the old one, you put the new one, and follow the directions that come with it because it will tell you how to apply the paste correctly.
How to apply thermal paste. Yeah.
And if you don't have it already, I'd recommend that you download a utility that can monitor your CPU and motherboard temperature, system temperature. There's, I think, one called Motherboard Monitor. Is that?
It's not a bad idea.
Yeah.
But you got to know what the range is of the CPU.
Yeah.
Well, you have to do some research to
you
really
can watch
find
the
out.
Heat go up, and as soon as it crashes, you know that's too high.
But you can track, like, what kind of activity. Is it really your CD-ROM, or is it really gaming, or
it's
some
processor.
Sort of process?
And that's assuming he doesn't have a motherboard where you can just set the BIOS settings that when it reaches a certain temperature, just cut the CPU down so that it's not running as fast.
That's a good point. But, okay.
Is it possible that it's injuring the computer, the motherboard in any way when this happens?
More likely the CPU.
No. You know, the
no,
CPU.
Not likely. It'll cut out.
The CPU has special circuitry built into it, that specific one, a Pentium 4, to where when it starts running hot, it'll throttle, which means it'll run at half the speed so it doesn't get as hot. But if you don't have a good connection to the heat sink, it'll actually cut off.
It throttles and then it gets all hot.
Yeah, it gets too hot and then it just cuts off. So there, you're not really hurting your CPU too much. I mean, you are.
You're doing thermal stress on it, so that's not a good thing. In fact, it's not going to do.
But when you install the heat sink, what I recommend is put a little thermal paste on the top of the CPU and on the heat sink itself on the bottom where they're actually going to connect. Use your finger, rub it around, make sure both surfaces are covered with a thin layer. Put them together, and that will ensure they have contact.
Now, this thermal
any bubbles
paste,
in there.
This thermal paste is white, and when
sometimes
you spread
it's gray.
It thin and, or gray, when you spread it thin enough, you can actually see through it. Do you want to be at a point where you can see through it or not?
Yeah, you don't want it to be thick, because then you've created an insulating layer.
Yeah, that's not
and then
good.
Heat doesn't conduct through it.
So how much? Is it an arc?
That's why
you
use a finger and just do a thin amount. It's really microscopic. Think about it. It's a microscopic connection.
Like putting on makeup almost, like a light base on your face, right?
You want to make sure the metal's covered, but don't lay it on thick. It's not like you're icing a cake.
Got it.
So
good.
Just
the
pressure
software?
Of the...
Oh, yeah, the software for monitoring?
I think one was called Motherboard Monitor.
Motherboard Monitor.
It's been a little while, but that's what I recall it being.
Okay.
Sean,
you know
I'm
what?
Go
to the motherboard manufacturer. When you're inside your case, write down the motherboard model number. And maker, right?
Yeah.
If it's ASUS, go to ASUSUSA.com. All these motherboard manufacturers have monitoring applications for your motherboard, and they're free.
Okay.
So just go download that, and it'll be specific for your motherboard.
Thanks so much for the call.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was motherboard monitor.
From Fort Ord, we have Rick. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Good morning.
What's your question today?
The question is, I want to network in my house two laptops and a basic
router.
PC. Uh-huh. Yeah. And I've attempted to do it with just two laptops 6 months ago. I bought a D-Link unit, and for some reason or another, it burned out. It never worked. I never had connectivity. So I just want a really simple recommendation.
Do you have DSL or cable?
Yes. Unfortunately, here in Fort Ord, we're locked into using Verizon Wireless, which is a kind of a strange situation, but that's our ISP carrier.
And are they providing wireless broadband?
Yes, they are.
That doesn't sound good.
So are you trying to use wireless as your networking mechanism, or are you actually using Ethernet cables for your laptops to connect to each other?
Well, we want to go wireless. I want to have the PC hardwired, but I want to have the laptop, wireless connectivity.
Yeah, you probably need to change your setup so that you have a wireless router that somehow bridges to your existing Verizon Wireless ISP, and then have only your laptops talking to your own router versus the Verizon Wireless directly. Otherwise, you're going to have a conflict of networks.
And I wouldn't be surprised if Verizon Wireless is going to make sure that the MAC address of the wireless connection is registered with them. So it's going to get a little complicated to add in a new wireless configuration. Yeah. But in any case, with your computers connected to each other, you need a couple things for this to work. You need it to one of the machines, or the router itself, has to supply DHCP, or Dynamic Host Client Protocol, DHCP. Any case, the thing that hands out IP addresses to all the machines. And any of these things off the shelf should work. I'm assuming you had a lemon, or probably a power problem when you plugged it in, that kind of thing messed it up. The other thing you want to be really careful about is the cables. You don't want the cables. If you're making your own cables, never plug them in and clip the cable to make the new cable, because you will fry the port. So you want to make sure you have good cables. And it really is like you get one of these routers off the shelf, a home unit thing. You probably don't need to configure it all. You plug in all the computers, and they should be able to get DHCP from that router. But that's going to be complete conflict with your wireless provider's data, the IP addresses. So you're going to have a bit of a confusion there.
Okay.
I would say that you want to talk with, if you can get one of these people to talk with you, one of the best ways possibly is to drive around until you see one of their vans, the people that actually install the wireless, and talk to them about what they recommend, because they're going to know their wireless solution. And they might actually have a router that does this for you, hooks up to their network and gives you a local Ethernet connection.
Right. Actually, Verizon doesn't, but I will try to find a local rep anyway. I've had to do everything through their website and their tech support, which is lacking.
Okay. We're going to go on. Thank you so much for the call.
Thank you.
Good luck. Norm from Santa Cruz, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello.
Hi. What's your question today?
I called last week about a Windows update problem on shutdown. Continually getting...
Right. And we suggested that you go ahead and run the update manually while the machine was on instead of shutting down. And what happened for you?
Right, so I did that, and it looks like there's a Flash Player update, which is causing the problem. It's downloaded onto my machine, but it fails to install every time.
Okay, so go ahead and find that file and delete it, and then go to Adobe and download the most recent Flash Player without dealing with Microsoft Update. So just go do that individually.
Right, and then the next time you go get updates, it'll see that it's updated.
And it won't try to download it again.
Okay, so delete that file and then go to Adobe for the Flash Player and get the latest one.
That's right.
Good. And then when you go get the new updates, just tell it you don't want the Flash Player if it's not smart enough to figure out that you have the latest Flash.
In fact, you could do that right now if you just go into the Windows Update, or if you expand it all out and find the one that says Flash and just uncheck it. It won't download and install it.
I did that, but you see it's already downloaded on my machine.
So it's trying to run it. So you got to find that file and delete it.
Okay. When I did uncheck the download, though, I get an error message. And
I would say that file has a bad file handle on it. Something's wrong with the file on the computer. And I wouldn't be averse to you running a disk check on your computer as well.
Got it.
All right. Good luck.
Thanks
for the call, Norm. Thanks for the update. You know, it's very rare that people call back and say, hey, you know, this is what happened next. So we help people, but we never really know if anything works. From Salinas, Tony, welcome to Geek Speak.
Yes, good morning. I have a very quick comment about the question you raised earlier about the right of the New Jersey Turnpike Authority to impose a copyright on ordinarily government agencies, and it's become more common for them to do this, to claim a copyright of images and anything occurring within their
control
area.
Sure.
But that's typically for a commercial purpose, for somebody to make money. I am calling because I want to note that I really question their authority to do this in light of the right of citizens to make citizen arrests. You may recall about 10 years ago, there was an individual who was posting images of tailgaters, speeders, and really bad, dangerous drivers on Highway 17.
Sure, the Highway 17 website. So
that's
right.
And yeah, sure. What was the right of Caltrans to force them to shut down? I mean, there was absolutely no right.
I don't know about that case very well. But what Miles did clarify on this story about New Jersey is that the equipment that was used to record this was New Jersey equipment. So they're claiming that, of course, that since it was their equipment, it's their ownership of the work.
State of New Jersey equipment?
Yeah, well, actually, probably the turnpike managers. Totally different story.
Where the Highway 17 belonged, that camera, I think, belonged to the guy who was...
Yeah, it was his camera.
It was his camera.
Yeah, and I think that I don't know what happened with that case. I'd love to. We should find that guy and
I remember he would have daily, you know, who's the jerk of the road.
Yeah,
today.
Yeah.
Right.
It was a great blog. It was like one of the first blogs.
Yeah, it was really cool.
Prior to blogs being called blogs. Well, thank you so much for the call. I agree that, and one of the reasons why Miles brought up this case is that we're, as geeks, we're highly aware of copyright, patent issues, and citizens' rights issues. So
okay,
that's
well,
why I brought it up.
I sure hope that we can get those cameras back again.
I think so, too. I think it would be great to have them available. Thank you so much.
Have a great day.
Thank you. You're listening to Geek Speak. We have Miles Elam, Sean Cleveland, Ryder Brooks. I'm Lyle Troxa. We're taking your calls with questions and comments of technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. From Felton, my Aunt Virginia. Hi, Virginia. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi, Lyle. Hey, I have a question. It's sort of a broad question, unlike some of these more specific ones, which is I just got a new Prius. And
Rub it in.
Mm-hmm. Rub it in. But I chose not to get the navigation system because it was so expensive. And then when you go to the store and you look at what a navigation system in a box or in a phone cost, they're so much cheaper. And I'm wondering, why is there really a difference in the content or the connection? Why is it in a Prius does it cost thousands of dollars, but in a box it costs a couple hundred, or in a phone even less?
Because it's tied into your dashboard.
Because it's so cool. Because my son Wyatt then calls it a Superman car. That's the only reason. I really think it has to do with the integration of the system. Mm-hmm. But Toyota's basically making a profit on those, just like they make a profit on air conditioning and so on. Sean, do you have some opinions on this?
Yeah, I think it's more expensive because of the integration. It's integrated into your audio interface. I mean, you could probably get that sort of thing in an off-the-shelf. I rented a car on vacation recently, and I got the navigation system, and it was just this little handheld unit.
That kind of locked onto the side?
It actually stuck it to my windshield, and it just kind of stayed there. And it was kind of, it didn't sound that great. It was tinny, but it worked just fine. Yeah. I got by with it.
And now you,
except whenever I parked, I had to stow it away because I was afraid somebody was going to steal it.
But the technology is the same in all these different devices. But actually, what you can get, the information that you get from all these devices is similar.
There's some varying degrees.
The base pretty technology is there, but at the same time, you can make a chair out of whittling some wood, and it would be the exact same wood as the wood that's in the chair that you're sitting on at home. But
you know
there's
what? Let's move on to the real stuff.
Well, can
Prius
I say first,
is much more sophisticated because Prius has taken it with their Bluetooth handset capability. I can actually look for specific bookstores. I can bring up, okay, bookstores in California. I'm looking for this one, and then it'll pop up, and there's a phone number, right? And I can say I want to call this, and it works through my cell phone. Well, I can also say I want to go there, and it's got the address already in the database, and then it just through GPS tells me how to get there. So there is a whole back end to this navigation system built into the Prius that is far better than what you would get in an off-the-shelf.
Yeah, and you're doing voice recognition, too.
Like, there's voice,
Sean, voice recognition. Where does that data get stored, and does it get updated? Like, what happens if the coffee shop closes, and you bought your car 2 years ago? How does that get updated?
When I take my car into Toyota for maintenance, they update
The library.
It's a DVD drive.
Now, so there's comparable technology on all these handheld devices. They have a database as well, and you can get them with restaurants in them, and then you can update them through your computer. So there's different ways of doing this. But Toyota's integration also with the phone, being able to say just dial.
Yeah.
Of course, that would be integrated with a phone, a handheld cell phone as well.
I've been in San Francisco and looked for restaurants, called, made a reservation, and then said, take me there. I've done that. Really cool.
And is it worth the extra expense, Sean?
I look at it as a monthly bill, and I'm a geek and I wanted everything. I couldn't see buying a car and being locked out of anything, so I just decided to go for it.
I should have talked to you before about the car, I guess.
No, because you know what? You don't need a navigation system in your car for it to work. And I mean, what's the car? What was the
Alex says I'm wrong. I'm reading his instant message here. He says I'm so wrong because off the shelves do this too.
Yeah, do a lot of those things too.
But I don't know.
Okay, so. What was the difference, Virginia? How much cost was it to get the navigation?
Around a couple thousand.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah. I mean, you can get portable GPS units for $300.
You can buy a new laptop and a portable GPS system for the laptop, which you wouldn't be able to use in California in your front seat, but for cheaper than that.
Yeah, never mind. Sean, you got fleeced.
I don't know, you guys, because when Sean and Wyatt and I went up to Berkeley recently, and Wyatt's in the back seat. And he looked at the screen, the map, moving along as we're driving. He said, "What? What is that?" And Sean said, "That's the map. That's where we are." And he pointed out the car. And Wyatt goes, "Oh my! Well, are you a superhero?"
No, he said, "This car is magic." That was cool.
It was probably pretty priceless. Anyways,
but you know, I would not buy a car without GPS personally. After having used it. Maybe I would buy an aftermarket if I really sat down and did comparisons and look at features. But the bottom line is I would want a GPS.
But let's put this in perspective. Sean has a GPS. He has an HDTV. He has a Blu-ray disc at home. He's got a phone, a BlackBerry, and probably, six computers high-end? So you're a technical rich person. He's a geek. All of us are, right? So, I mean, there's a lot of technology that Sean digs. But, Sean, do you think everybody should have GPS? Do you think that Miles could use it in his car? Is he capable?
It's personal opinion. It's really up to you.
Yeah, but I mean, I think geeks really dig on that technology. I hate that I don't have a GPS system. Like, it frustrates me.
See, I personally enjoy getting lost, so I don't want a GPS at all.
Why do you enjoy getting lost, Miles?
Well, you see all sorts of different areas that you wouldn't think to go before.
Okay, well, there you go.
I know, it's strange, it's weird.
All right, thanks for the call, Virginia.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
Let's see. Can we take a couple more calls? I think we do. I think we can. I'm lost track of who's who on this list. Let's see. Line 6 is one of the geeks. You reading this?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Larry, Atlanta, Georgia. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Hello.
Hi, Larry. What's your question today?
I'm sorry. First, you say thank you. Thank you so much for taking my call. You guys are brilliant. I want to thank you. I called you last week and gave me an answer. It helped me a lot. Okay, question for you. I'm calling because I happen to run a very small business, a one-man business. I run a small one-man service business. And what I like to do is have a website, but also ask you guys the best way I can market my website. What I do basically is I help property owners either avoid or get rid of deadbeat tenants. So I just wonder if you are my shoes. Exactly what would you do to market your web page?
Just a website?
Yeah.
I think one of the tricks is to get a lot of people to link to you. Get your website to have really good content so it's a good space to be in. What's the service that you provide? Website design?
Sure. What I do, my friend, is I help local property owners either avoid or manage what I call deadbeat tenants.
Okay. I think that you probably have to try and find trade magazines that are in that service vein. I mean, because you have a very close dynamic. But I'm not an expert on marketing websites. Any of the geeks have suggestions on this?
Yeah.
Well, one thing that I've seen, not an expert myself, but one thing I've seen is making sure that you have the site updated on a regular basis so that people always have a reason to come back. So not just getting the audience. Like, Lyle, when you were saying having people link to you, that's one way of doing it, but also getting people to come back to it so they go, oh, well, I have to go back tomorrow because it's always different tomorrow. There's always something new.
Adding more information.
Right.
So you lock on to people that are, you know, that's good.
Guys, question for you. Guys, I've read articles about using different web services which will post your site to different search engines. As far as you know, are those services any good?
I don't particularly like them, but I know a lot of people use them and it works well for them. I think if you can afford the expense, they're definitely going to do a good job of suggesting how you can improve your site to be on better listings and to submit you. But in general, web engines, search engines, they crawl websites, they find you. So the trick is to making your page work for them.
Don't change your content, your basic content on your page too much, because it gets cached and then it gets searched. They need to make sure that your content is put together, your page is put together in such a way that it makes it easy for Google to find that data.
Right, and if you try to game the system too much, you'll end up with search engines blacklisting you.
Yeah,
and then you end up just not getting
fear,
seen at all.
That's the fear with these providers that say, we'll get you on high rankings, is that if they're cheating, Google will take it out on you and they'll cut off your searching, basically. You won't be indexed anymore.
But doing a little research on how Google does search for pages, what can you do to your page to make it more likely that your page comes higher up on the list? That's worth doing some research.
Google has a great pages for that. He says, you know, it's a whole system in Google for webmasters saying, this is how you do good.
Yeah.
And they
should
have
totally
great
do
suggestions.
That then, yeah.
Yeah, Google's got great suggestions. So I take a look at that, and thank you so much for the call.
Thanks, guys.
We're going to take one more call today from Santa Cruz. Woody, welcome to GeekSpeak. Hi, George, actually. We're with George. Hi, George. What's your call?
Well, I may actually have to come up and bug Lyle personally on this one, but... basically, I'm a contractor who does on-site support for computing, and I had a client who had a Linksys hub router, like a four-port hub router plugged into their DSL service.
Mm-hmm.
That was bridged to a large wired network, you know, just basically all Ethernet lines out to the various machines in the building.
Okay.
And then they had a wireless hub router, another Linksys device, a little four-port hub router, that was connected to that original Linksys device that was basically just acting as a bridge. It was allowing wireless clients to connect to this wired network and share resources on the office network.
Okay.
The problem was that the office network had some networked printers hanging off of its subnet, and you know, it was working fine. And then one day, you know, they relocated this wireless hub router device, and suddenly the wireless clients could not access the printers. They couldn't send print jobs to the printers. They couldn't even see them on the network. Now, most of the clients on this network are Windows XP clients, and what I went in to try and do was make that wireless device just a bridge. So it recognizes.
I see. And using the original network. You know, we're running out of time, and it sounds like a pretty interesting discussion. I'd love to do the off air. So stay on the phone with us if you would, and we're going to have to finish up the show today. The Geeks,
all right, thank you.
The Geeks this morning were Miles Elam, Ryder Brooks, and Sean Cleveland answering the phones. Rick Philman, thank you all for participating in GeekSpeak.
Yeah, thank you, Lyle.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to GeekSpeak. And to those that called in, thank you for making GeekSpeak what it is. Without you, it'd just be us geeking out, and who wants to listen to that? GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. The next 2 weeks, KUSP is doing a radio auction live from downtown Santa Cruz. You're welcome to learn all about it at kusp.org. It's a great way to find out about new businesses and to support KUSP. But due to that, we will not be here for 3 weeks. So next week and the week after, GeekSpeak will not be on air. 3 weeks, come back. If you really want to be involved with GeekSpeak, you're welcome to visit our website during that time and catch up on old shows, geekspeak.org. GeekSpeak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KBDH Santa Auto. We are online at kusp.org.